Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The author who became famous defining Generation X is out with a new novel about a high school shooting, religion, suburbia, lost victims, and their families. In Hey Nostradamus, Douglas Copeland takes us into a school cafeteria as a gun-toting trio massacre their classmates and overturn the lives of survivors. Tonight on Point, novelist Douglas Copeland on God and Sudden Death. But first, Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz today took President Bush's request for another $87 billion for Iraq and Afghanistan to the Senate Armed Services Committee. He got a grilling, but will also very likely get the money. Gail Shattuck is a congressional reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. I asked her to describe the Senate's mood after the hearing.
I think there are questions that are being asked openly now and aggressively, more so than at any point in the war. You've had people like Senator Lugar and Senator Biden, who are the chairman and ranking member on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, quietly raising questions about what is the planning for the post-war. Come and tell us what your plans are for months now. And it really didn't happen. This is the point where, especially for Democrats, they consider this a moment of reckoning, looking at an $87 billion request and a war that is aftermath that is not going well. There is a mood for heads to roll among many Democrats and even moderate Republicans.
Well, there was Wolfowitz saying, look, give us this money and give it to us quick. He said the sooner these terrorists and Baathists understand clearly that our will cannot be broken, the sooner we will win. That's putting a kind of direct pressure on Congress on the other angle, saying we have to have a unified front here.
There is no question that Congress is going to give them the money they need for the war. Absolutely none. Even people that opposed the war initially now feel with troops in harm's way you support them, period. However, I really feel that the pressure is coming from the other direction at this point. The Deputy Defense Secretary especially has questions to answer when General Shinseki, then head of the Army, suggested months ago that a much larger troop presence was going to be needed. Deputy Secretary just dismissed it out of hand, said it was way off the mark.
And now it's very clear that,
that
more troops are being called for.
Exactly.
The chairman of the Armed Services Committee, John Warner, Virginia Republican, urged lawmakers today to resolve to stay behind this president and this team. But you say you're feeling a kind of itch for heads to roll. How great is the danger, and to which heads?
One of the most interesting reports I've seen is an article in the Weekly Standard, which is the kind of Bible for a trend of thought that is called neocon in this city. And this is a group that was way out front early on saying the war is important. We need to change the character of the Middle East entirely to be safe from terrorism. Mm-hmm. And it's in this journal that you're seeing the first shots fired basically at the defense secretary, for holding to what they claim was too rigid a view that we need to prepare to fight a modern war, and that the idea of the modern war with fewer troops, more mobile, more high-tech, was so important that they were willing to miss opportunities to shore up the presence that we have in a more conventional way.
But then we've got this interesting situation where you have kind of anti-war voices from one side criticizing the Bush team, and from the other side, very conservative voices saying that the U.S. didn't go in heavy enough. These different perspectives likely to make common cause?
Well, I think it may, in terms of the credibility of individuals within the administration. Senator McCain, for example, is someone who has also been a very strong supporter of the war, just came back from a trip to Iraq, and has been saying all along we need a much stronger troop presence. And at the same time, you have someone like Ben Nelson from Nebraska, who's going to be holding hearings next month in Nebraska on the impact on reservists of suddenly being told that they're going to be there for much longer than they expected. There's also, Tom, a really interesting report that surfaced this week from the Congressional Budget Office that talks about whether or not we have the force strength we need for a long haul in Iraq. What would it take? And their conclusion is we may need two more Army divisions, and that'll take 5 years.
To build that up, to recruit, are people talking about a draft or simply ramping up recruiting for the U.S. Armed Forces?
Right now it's ramping up recruiting. No one is at that point yet, but it gives you a sense of the magnitude of the numbers that are being looked at. Instead of just, you know, supporting what the administration is saying and a united front, there is now a very wide range of opinions. And I take your point about Senator Warner. He said something quite interesting. He said that now is not the time to try to assess what went right and what went wrong and who may be at fault for faulty vision. You know, we have to stay strong. Nonetheless, I don't think you'll find a member of Congress that believes that we should not support our troops that are there, or that it is not critically important that this war be won.
On the other hand, we see this ABC News poll released this week saying that the number of Americans who say the war in Iraq will cut the long-term risk of terrorism has slipped to just 40%, down from 58% the week after the fall of Baghdad. That suggests Americans themselves are not entirely convinced of the linkage here.
Well, you know, that is a problem that was known from the start. I was talking to John Zogby, a pollster, yesterday about this, and he was telling me about polls he did just a couple of weeks into the war where he was asking levels of support, and he asked people if the war lasted a year, you know, would you support it? If it lasted 2 years, with each increment, the level of support went down. And I think the images that the American public are seeing now are bringing home the point that this war could take quite a bit longer. It's not surprising that public support is falling.
Finally, Gail, on the bottom line issue for Congress and appropriations, what does this new huge amount of money, $87 billion, do to the deficit? Does it push it over $500 billion in the next year?
Yes. That we know. It's over $500 billion. But what's very interesting is that fact has not registered clearly in Congress yet. I was just talking to people like Senator Collins, who were very doubtful about the size of a tax cut, very concerned about the deficit, you know, for her entire career here. And she's saying, look, the economy is in such bad shape, the deficit might actually stimulate it initially. The tax cuts might help with growth, and that will reduce the deficit. But now, in the middle of a war with so much at stake, is not the time to worry about the deficit. I suspect others will agree with her. The one exception I would make, and I think this is an interesting one, is I'm wondering the impact this will have on the Medicare prescription drug plan, which is $400 billion, and that's probably a low-ball estimate. That bill is having a lot of trouble right now in conference, and the war might just be an excuse for not getting it done after all.
So there may be ramifications on the home front in a fiscal sense. Gail Shattuck, thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to.
Gail Shattuck is congressional reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke with me from Washington. In his new novel, Hey Nostradamus, Douglas Copeland follows four characters, each in one way or another the victim of a horrendous high school shooting. Their memories rattle their lives and the lives around them. Copeland wrote about his fictional Columbine-style shooting in the aftermath of September 11, 2001, when America and the world grappled with a much larger attack. The themes of terror and loss resonate today. Tonight we talk to Douglas Copeland about violence, recovery, and the search for redemption. How do we process sudden, stunning violence from Oklahoma City to Columbine to 9/11? What are the fundamental conditions in a house, in a town, in the world that spark seemingly senseless killing? And what makes one person turn to religion and another to the gun and some to both? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me from Vancouver, Canada, is novelist Douglas Copeland. His debut novel, Generation X, came out in 1991. Since then, he has written, among others, Micro Serfs, Miss Wyoming, and City of Glass. His new book, Hey Nostradamus, is his 10th novel. Good evening and welcome, Douglas Copeland.
Tom, thank you. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you. Thanks so much for being along. So here's your book out right into the teeth of another 9/11 anniversary. But the thing that you've written about, while the whole country has been up in arms over Manhattan and the Pentagon and everything on that day, was an earlier violent outburst that had everyone's attention, a kind of Columbine-style shooting, terror, death. Douglas Copeland, why did you choose to look back to Columbine as the rest of the country was staring at the hole in the ground in Manhattan?
You know what? I began writing the book on my birthday, December 30th, about 3 months after 9/11. And we all remember the fog of horror and shock and grief that was in the air. And what happened with me is I looked back into the recent past to find something similar. The scale didn't matter, but a similar sort of shared event, and used that as a seed crystal. And Columbine seemed to have been, that was 97, just enough in the past that we had distance on it that we could maybe not be right in the thick of it the way we were with 9/11.
And so there it was for you, a smaller scale, and you honed right in on it. We should make clear, you're talking to us from Vancouver tonight. You set this story in Vancouver. We don't really associate Canada with Columbine-style slaughter, but you managed to set it quite comfortably there. Have we missed something about our neighbors to the north, Douglas Copeland? You've got a kind of degraded, sort of David Lynch eeriness about the setting there. Is that the Vancouver you grew up and live in?
Oh, Tom, I don't want to play a game of one-downmanship here, but I think that virtually all Western industrial nations have had shootings. We had a horrible one in Montreal at the École Polytechnique, where I think 16 women were shot. Japan has had incidents like this. England has had them. I think it's sort of a fact of life, no matter where you are. But I think to set it in Vancouver in 88, which was such a completely peaceful, neutral environment, I think that almost amplified the shock of the incident which occurs in the book.
You set it in 88, and then the story is told through the voices of four characters throughout the book. One high school girl who dies in the shooting rampage in the cafeteria of her high school there. Her boyfriend, and more than that, I guess, her secret husband, who has learned on the day of the shooting that she is pregnant. And then another woman who comes on the scene. And finally, the boy's father, who carries a very heavy load of pretty tortured religion through the book. Doug Copeland, what are you saying about religion in Hey Nostradamus? You've got redemption maybe in the young girl's life or death, but pretty shadowy, dark take on religion in most of the rest of the book.
I don't see it as dark. What's really become clear to me since I began writing this book is the two polarities within which we live our lives. And at the beginning of the book, there is a short passage from Corinthians. And if you told me 10 years ago I would be putting such a thing in my books, I'd have not believed you. But here's what it says. Behold, I tell you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet. For the trumpet will sound, and the dead will be raised imperishable, and we shall be changed. And I found that on the tombstone of a young boy who was shot at Columbine. And to me, that represents one side of being alive, which is that no matter what happens, there still is. Well, Andy Warhol did a painting just before he died called Heaven and Hell Are Just a Breath Away. And that at any moment, something wonderful and magical can transport you away. And yet we go to the very first paragraph in the book.
Yeah.
So you go, wham, which is the opposite polarity, which is this. And it's Cheryl speaking. Cheryl is 17. And she says, I believe that what separates humanity from everything else in this world, spaghetti or binder paper, deep sea creatures, Edelweiss or Mount McKinley, it's that humanity alone has the capacity at any given moment to commit all possible sins. Now, I don't want to sound like a radio preacher here. But I mean, what that means, though, Tom, is that, like, okay, I'm in this radio station here. I could go out and stab the guy in the booth with a knife. I could swipe equipment. I could say horrible things. That just by being alive, I'm capable of doing all these things. And yet, at the other end of the spectrum, we can all be changed in a wonderful way. And it seemed to me that with September 11th, that was just one of the many things that became evident about being alive and being human. And so this is the drama which sort of represents that struggle.
Well, we are swinging hard between those poles these days. And in your book, Douglas Copeland, the new book is Hey Nostradamus. We're talking with Doug Copeland tonight about sudden violence and long recovery and the age of random loss. You can join the conversation. How do we process sudden, stunning violence from Oklahoma City to Columbine to 9/11? What are the fundamental conditions in a home, a town, the world that spark seemingly senseless killing? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with novelist Douglas Copeland about sudden violence, long recovery, and the age of random loss. His new book is Hey Nostradamus, and it's a story of lives revolving around the massacre in a Canadian high school, 1988. The reverberations go on for many, many years and play out through religion and relationships and some very long and difficult nights and circumstances. You can join the conversation tonight. Is religion a greater comfort or curse, and what makes one young man turn to religion and another to a gun, and some to both? If Douglas Copeland has his finger on the cultural pulse here, what is this novel telling us? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Douglas Copeland, I wish you'd do a little bit of a reading for us, maybe from page 77. Cheryl dies, and she speaks to us from beyond the pale, from the dead. Many readers will know that from Alice Siebold's The Lovely Bones. You must have sworn when she came out with that, and you were already into writing your book with the same.
Oh, actually, no. I've done two books before with dead teenage narrators.
Oh, well, then you're very familiar with dead teenagers.
I'm familiar with the format.
Speaking poignantly from the other side. Oh, Alice Siebold copied you then.
No.
No, of course. But she's very sweet, and she's very persuasive from that side. But Jason is left behind, and there's this amazing situation where he, on the one hand, he saves most of the school from slaughter, but in that way that people can turn ugly and suspicious around events like this. He's also accused for a while of being the guy who may have masterminded the whole thing. And you've got this incredible passage where he's come home. He's still numb after the terrible bloody violence of this day, a cafeteria just swimming in blood. And he proceeds to have an interaction with his hyper-religious father that wounds them both for a very long time. Could you read just that page to us, Douglas Copeland?
Okay, so we're in the family living room, and the police are there. And an officer said, "Well, we have to question your son, sir." And Mom was in the background wailing, "Oh, God, Cheryl's dead." And Reg, the father, says, "Well, why do you need to question Jason?" "It's procedure, sir." "Jason, why are they questioning you?" And Jason says, "Well, you tell me." And Mom said, "Didn't you hear me?" And Dad ignored Mom and, by extension, Cheryl. "What does my son have to do with any of this, officer?" "Well," one of the cops said, "he was right there in the cafeteria, and if he hadn't thrown that rock, who knows how many more fatalities there might have been." Reg, the father, says, "Rock?" "Yes, sir, your son's quick thinking saved..." And the other cop cuts in, "Yes, that boulder killed the main gunman." And Jason says, "Gunman, he was 15, tops, he was a boy." And Dad turned to me, "You killed a boy today." And the policeman said, "Your son is a hero, sir." And Jason said... Rather, the father says, "Jason, did you kill a boy today?" And Jason says, "Yeah." "Did you intend to kill him?" And Jason said, "Well, yes, I did. Would you rather have him shoot me?" "That's not what I asked you, Jason. I asked if you had intended to kill him." "Mr. Clausen," the first cop said, "perhaps you don't understand. Your son's actions saved the lives of dozens of students." And Reg, my father, looked at him. "What I understand is that my son experienced murder in his heart and chose not to rise above that impulse. I understand that my son is a murderer."
And there it is from Douglas Copeland's new novel, Hey Nostradamus, the hero of a very gory and horrible day comes home and is categorized as a murderer by his very religious father. Wow, that's cruel. And you've got a character here who takes a decade and more trying to get over it, Doug Copeland.
I have this belief that the harder you try not to become your parents, the quicker you become them. And I think that what you have, well, let me put it this way, Tom. My great-grandparents were all, we call Bible thumpers in the Canadian prairies, the turn of the century, a more grim or gruesome job or calling I couldn't imagine. And my grandparents and my own parents, in reaction to that, moved out to the west of Canada and, in an informed way, raised myself and my brothers without religion. And I think what happened is that either subconsciously or consciously, I think it is nurture, not nature, signals are passed down, and I somehow got that gene or that behavior. And how do the children become the parents, and how are the sins passed along? And you have Reg, I mean, I hate to think he's like a Simon Legree character. I mean, he's just so intrinsically awful. But when you try to, oh gosh, I'm making a muddle of things here, Tom. But again, the harder you try not to be your parents, you do become them. And you try and avoid their sins, and you go right out and commit them even faster than you would have otherwise.
I was fascinated the way, Douglas Coleman, you've got the notion of sin woven all through the book, and yet you barely touch on the three shooters in the high school. They appear in their camouflage outfits and with their rifles and shotguns, and they slaughter dozens, and they're off stage. For all the talk of sin, it's not really related to them. It's the people who stay behind. In this case, a handful of people in the families you focus on nationally right now. Maybe all of the United States, all of North America after 9/11, sticking behind, thinking about aftermath, and you cast this net of sin over all that, and conversation around sin. Is that the survivors asking themselves if they somehow brought this on themselves?
No, I don't think it's that. Tom, one thing I've noticed, and it's been a while now since I finished the book, I look back on the experience and I think of all the photos and all the news clips that I saw of Columbine and the students there, and I read about the lives they led. And it seems to me that Columbine was more, it resembled a factory or a machine for manufacturing students. And then I began to think, well, maybe, and I mean no disrespect by this, but maybe what you had at Columbine was a sort of workplace type shooting that just happened to take place in a factory disguised as a school. And there's a certain genericness to workplace shootings. And the bad guys get enough press in this world. I just wanted these people who came out the other end, you know, what of them? I want, what did happen to them? In real life, some very interesting things did happen. There was one girl, I won't mention any names, there was a quite famous incident of where one of the gunmen said, "Do you believe in God?" And the story goes that she said yes, and she was shot for that.
At Columbine, right.
Yeah. And, well, how much do we believe? How much do we believe in faith after so much violence? I think, boy, I think we're all, you know, the worst thing about September 11th, and I'm sure everyone out there is probably going to agree with me, it was the jumpers. Yeah. And I can't imagine there's anyone out there who hasn't imagined themselves in that place, in that fear, and that horror, and the braveness they would have taken, the bravery it would have taken, the jump. And it seems that somehow we've been with the jumpers ever since, and we didn't have them before 9/11. And it's this new entity that we digest. It's sort of an evil that we now have to make space for in our culture.
That image so powerful.
Oh, it was awful. What I did, I took some images of them and I turned them upside down and put them on my website and said, jumpers now rising as if ascending to heaven, and to make some sort of just peace for them. And I had to take them off because of copyright reasons. But in my head, I like to think, okay, no, they're going up. They're going to heaven. They're not falling at all.
Douglas Copeland, you are also, in fact, before you were known as a writer, you were known as a sculptor. You continue to be a sculptor. And I've seen some photographs of the image that's also on the cover of the new novel, Hey Nostradamus. You've got a kind of kneeling figure, and it's ambiguous to my eye whether this figure is kneeling waiting to be executed or kneeling in prayer. You've sculpted a lot of these at a considerable size. The message seems awfully close to the message of the book.
It's a strange thing that happened. I don't know if your listeners have seen the cover, but it's a pictogram. I took a photograph of it at Phoenix's Sky Harbor Airport in 2001, and it's of a kneeling figure, and it's non-denominational, and it seemed appropriate for the cover. And then
This is the same kind of figure that you see sometimes on an exit sign, a very round, anthropomorphic human figure, maybe dashing for the exit. It's that, if the smiley face had a body, it might look something like this one.
Yeah, and so I made the body, and I made them in three dimensions, and something very strange happened, that if you take a kneeling figure, a praying figure, bowing in prayer, and you put it up against a wall, suddenly it's being executed. And there's this really fine line, again, what we spoke of earlier, between transcendence and beauty and extreme sin. And I almost scared myself with how evident that became with just this one figure. And gosh, I mean, I'm in this radio booth right now, and I've got goosebumps thinking about it. It just really freaked me out.
So on the one hand, you've got that fine line between prayer and sin or moment of terror. I was struck also at the fine line that you draw right through your characters. You have one of your characters say, I mean, on the one hand, we've got real victims here who suffer a lot. On the other hand, one of your characters says, these days, I think that everybody's just one spit away from being a mall bomber. So is everybody really carrying around that kind of Columbine impulse?
No, but I think we're far more aware that it exists, and I think we're not quite so naive anymore about what people are capable of. I think that we've gone from trusting people to instead looking at them, establishing what they're capable of doing, and then protecting ourselves against their capabilities. So we've gone from a trust culture to one of capability prophylaxis, capability management.
Capability management meaning that capability to kill is there.
Yeah, like, okay, well, they mean well, but I know they've got a rifle in the basement, so do I get a rifle too? And, does the violence escalate? Another thing that comes to mind with September 11 and is that you have the notion of modernity versus the notion of eternity. I remember, I'm sure you remember, in the late 80s, early 90s, they said, oh, history's over. It was Francis Fukuyama. And it seemed like modernity had triumphed. And then suddenly you had these people who believe completely in eternity, sort of destroying the monument to modernity. And what I think is happening here, Tom, to put it more simply, is that there's this thing we have out there called the future, and when you and I die, there's still going to be a year 3,510. But then the moment you die, you go to the afterworld, and there's no overlap between the future and the afterworld. And now suddenly, we're almost having to choose between the two of them. Do we believe in eternity, or do we want, to make a better tomorrow through the application of science? And it's gotten quite confusing, and we're not at the end of history, but we're at the end of a certain way of thinking about history.
I have heard that conversation even around some distant family dinner tables.
Well, surely,
and you make it. You've got it on almost every page. People coming home from a job, whether they're a court stenographer or however mundane, working in a donut shop, watching the evening news, and then sitting down and talking about the world in the most kind of apocalyptic terms, and this exactly this line, whether it's worth trying or whether it's all about the soul and the afterlife and redemption. And it seems to me that you've really populated this book with people who decide the latter.
Well, there does need to be hope. There really does. I mean, part of writing Well, Hey Nostradamus was creating a path of some sort that would allow me to discuss God with the people in my life. And it's a very hard thing to do. And when you bring up the subject, people are either confused and embarrassed, or they talk to me just as much as they need to establish that I'm somehow not like them. Another way, it's a cul-de-sac. And so if there's anything that comes out of Hey Nostradamus, it's some sort of dialogue I want to have, even if it's only inside a reader's head. I mean, what frustrates me is that discussing religion in detail only ever seems to create enemies, not friends. And it's become so incredibly divisive.
Yeah, either way.
And I think that it is a crisis of doctrine or a crisis of orthodoxy that they reached this almost like plutonium-like critical mass of self-destruction, and they've got to find things, everyone has to find things they agree on desperately, quickly, or else it really is all going to atomize.
We had the Dalai Lama, recording of the Dalai Lama on the show last night, and he was in Bloomington, Indiana, saying, whatever religion you believe, take the teaching seriously, because if you believe it in a kind of a halfway or a bastardized way, well, clearly that can make trouble. You've got your character Cheryl saying, to acknowledge God is to fully accept the sorrow of the human condition. Mm. And there seems an awful lot more of that than of joy in this novel, Douglas Copeland. You were first famous for Generation X and that whole slacker thing, and somehow here it's a slacker, grim, threadbare universe writ large.
Slacker. Everyone has good jobs.
Good jobs. When they're not drunk, building cabinets until they need to go get stoned.
You know, the thing about Generation X, and that was 1991.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a book I wrote, and I've always thought of it as such, and I love it, and I'm very happy, always been very happy with it. But it has sort of given me this, and I'm not putting myself in his league, but this Steven Soderbergh Sex, Lies, and Videotape thing that he had to get over, too, is that I've had to work, three times as hard to show that, it wasn't just a one-off kind of book, that there's actually other kinds of writing going here, which has actually been wonderful.
Yeah.
And because people expect me to experiment with every book. And this book, it was an experiment structurally and in terms of character on, sorrow, yes, but also of time and of free will. I think the one thing that does make us different from everything else in the universe is that we have time or awareness of time, and we have free will, and how we use those two devices defines us, who we are as people. And you have the four characters, and they've all used their time and free will differently, and they've all come to different ends or dead ends. I don't want to say what happens at the very end, because that would wreck the book. But
well, yeah. And there's a little mystery even there. Douglas Copeland, stand by. We're talking tonight about Douglas Copeland's new book, Hey Nostradamus, about sudden violence, long recovering, the age of random loss. Has Columbine been buried, in your mind, by the drama of 9/11? Are these two related, or are they worlds apart? And do you recognize the degraded, isolating world of Hey Nostradamus? Is it an invitation to violence? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with novelist Douglas Copeland about sudden violence, long recovery, the age of random loss, and his new novel, Hey Nostradamus. You can join the conversation. How do we process sudden, stunning violence from Oklahoma City to Columbine to 9/11? And what are the fundamental conditions in a home, in a town, in the world that spark seemingly senseless killing? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Renee is calling from Boston. Hi, Renee. You're on the air. Renee, have we got you there? Coming up. Hello, Renee.
First of all, I just want to say that I'm a really big fan of Douglas Copeland's work. I've read pretty much every book from the beginning.
And he's on his 10th now, so you've been busy with Douglas Copeland.
Yeah, yeah. Someone introduced me to him in high school, and yeah. It's always been a world I've felt comfortable in.
Have you read Hey Nostradamus yet?
Yes, I have. Yes,
and
I have.
What did you think?
I thought it was a wonderful book, and of course I recognize the world in that book. I mean, that's the world we've been living in since Columbine, if not before.
And what about it exactly? I mean, it struck me as this. Oh, there's many angles on it, but it's a sad, kind of degraded place that Douglas described the Columbine as a factory high school. This seems kind of like a factory world. Did you read it that way?
Well, the thing is, yeah, of course it's really grim, but that's pretty much the world I feel we're in. I mean, you can take it, like he said, either mm-hmm. way. I mean, religion can bring you to this really higher place and the ecstasy of that. But then again, a lot of people misinterpret it and it becomes this really violent thing. And I think that he captured both of those sides of the world pretty, pretty well. I don't really know. Excuse me, I'm kind of nervous. I didn't realize I'd get on the phone. But, you know, basically I just feel like, I mean, it is really dark, but I think that there was also a bit of hope there, too.
Absolutely. Douglas Copeland, here's a stone-cold fan and solid reader of all your books, has read this one already, and ready to look through the grimness and see hope there.
Well, yes. Tom, I'm going to go back and reverse here for a second. When we entered this segment, the jazz musicians were playing Smells Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana. That was wonderful. Do you know who that was playing it?
I don't think that was actually on the air. That was in your earphones.
Oh, was it? Oh,
yeah.
It was, okay. No,
but that's
like,
okay. But
it sounded like kind of like what I thought heaven would sound like. I'm quite thrilled.
Personally, for you,
I don't think the world is so degraded as you perhaps make it seem in the book. I think that what happens in the book is what happens to a lot of us. Is that whatever got you to a certain point in your life, be it 25, 30, 35, 40, 50. Isn't going to get you the rest of the way. And mm-hmm. so you have to figure out, well, how am I going to get the rest of the way? And I think for a large part of the population who aren't coming from any doctrine or orthodoxy, we're forced to cobble together these strange little micro-religions on our own, which really aren't adequate enough to help you make it through the world. And yet there's a distrust of the formalized view of the world. And how are you going to make a bridge between those two worlds? How do you make something real? How do you keep the future while maintaining eternity at the same time?
And the challenges to everyone's sense of equilibrium are so great that the impulse to try and figure out is huge.
Oh, it's the only thing that unites all people. It doesn't matter through history, regardless of time or place. It is that need to make sense. And I mean, I think the world's never made much sense, but now it seems to make even less sense than ever. My mother calls me an optimistic pessimist, and my father calls me a pessimistic optimist. And I don't know. I mean, the world has always been changing. It just happens to be changing faster at the moment. Over the last year or so, I've been asking people, you know, 60, 70, 80-somethings, you know, when in your life has it felt to you as if there's been the most change happening? And I thought they'd say the 60s, like the late 60s, mm-hmm. but they all say, oh, no, right now, absolutely right now, without a question. And I look back and, my God, how would you explain 2003 to someone from 1993? I mean, we've really gone a long way quickly. And I think we also have to give ourselves a little credit for, you know, staying relatively sane through it all.
Yeah, we'll give ourselves a modest pat on the back there. Renee, thanks for your call. Anne's calling from Boston. Hi, Anne. You're on the air.
Oh, hello. It's Gloucester.
Hello. Yes. Oh, Gloucester. Welcome, yeah. Anne. Hi.
Thank you. There's so many things come to mind. The feeling now, I think, is that reality is just so much, and it's too much for everybody to take in. So you either just shut it off and just say, I just have to go around my little day-to-day life and just do the washing and do the cooking and try to get to sleep and try to have enough money to live on. And I just can't think about everything. Because if you thought about everything, every single thing, you'd have to do something about. And it's just, you can't.
And what about the religious thread? Is that part of your coping mechanism or not?
Of course it is, because every single thing you do makes such a difference. And it's so important that you make all the right decisions.
But of course you never can.
Well, you can do the best you can. You can try.
Well.
And so that's all anyone could ever ask of you, or God could ever ask of you.
And we've got it. Douglas Copeland, I hear you there.
Oh, well, I think I like to, I'm a reductivist. I like to reduce things down to as minimally as possible. And I think if there's, okay, if you had to come up with some sort of starting point or seed crystal for faith, you could say, okay, there's something to believe in, number one. You could believe that the constant refinement of locating that belief and negotiating it day by day is number two. And number three is, I believe that we're just one iota more good than we are bad. If you take those things together and throw in time and free will, you've got just enough faith, I think, to get you through the world. But I think the world should be more than just a coping exercise. There does have to be some way to engage with the culture so that you can get the highs as well as the lows, and also to make the middle bearable, too. Because we're all mostly in the middle, let's face it.
You said, and thanks for your call. Douglas Copeland, you set this story up around a high school killing. But, of course, the United States, and in many ways the world, has been dealing with 9/11 during the same period that you were writing and bringing this book. How do you think that the U.S. across the border is handling the trauma?
A 9/11?
Yeah.
One thing I've noticed, and this might just be me, is that a year ago, on the first anniversary, it felt like it had just been a week since it had happened. And now, on the eve of the second anniversary, it feels like 10 years ago. And I was actually on the phone with some people in Manhattan today, and we were talking about it, and they said, yeah, somehow it feels very far in the past, the actual event, or the way we walked or sleepwalked through that event. But politically, well, we all heard the news just before this show began. I don't think we've really grasped how big it is yet. I think in terms of action, and well, we've had reaction, now we have to have action. And I think that action is where we're at the beginning of that now.
And when you watch the U.S. responding to it as a Canadian, does it look like a familiar response, or does it make you say, oh, those Americans?
Of course not. I think it was just a shocking, astonishing thing. Thousands of people killed in that act of senseless brutality. We're never going to make sense of it. You know, anyone who's there, I think, you know, it's bigger than the day JFK was shot. It's bigger than anything. It's just, for a lot of young people, believe it or not, this is the worst day of their lives, and they talk about it as such. And some of them can barely even talk about it. It was so affecting. Oh, no, it's going to reverberate for 1,000 years.
Well, we've got Douglas Copeland reverberating in Hey Nostradamus about a different kind of tragedy and killing, but a meditation that's useful on the eve of a new 9/11 anniversary. Douglas Copeland, I want to thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Tom, it has been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a look back at the career of controversial filmmaker Leni Riefenstahl. This is On Point. Controversial documentarian and photographer Leni Riefenstahl, long regarded as Hitler's favorite filmmaker, died yesterday at her home in Bavaria. She was 101 years old. Her ascent as a director mirrored the rise of the Nazi Party in Germany, which she exalted with chilling technique in films like Olympia and Triumph of the Will. Riefenstahl's innovative approach to lighting and photography reinforced Hitler's ideals of Aryan purity and realized the power of film as propaganda tool. Although she denied knowing anything of Hitler's final solution, she never apologized for her films. David Bathrick is professor and chair of theater, film, and dance at Cornell University. He remembers the revered and reviled Leni Riefenstahl.
Leni Riefenstahl started off as a dancer and very much thought of herself and dancing as something that was visionary, and visionary in its relationship to destiny, in her relationship to the natural world. She gets injured when she was 22 and could not dance anymore, and claims that one day, sitting in a subway station, she saw a poster of Arnold Funk's film, one of his mountain films, and knew that this is really another extension of that kind of vision. And so she got in touch with him and managed to convince him she was the one he was looking for in terms of both acting and also thinking artistically the way he was thinking. And then she involved herself in many of his films. She was not thinking in political terms, but certainly when one thinks in terms of visions and spectacles and mountains, it's not a very great leap to be also thinking of something Wagnerian. That also is what was important for both Goebbels and Hitler. They were not happy with the kinds of newsreel films and footage that was being made of Hitler and the party. They felt that it was much too traditionally documentary and coded into verbal message rather than into images. And even though she had never made a documentary film, they were willing to give her carte blanche, willing to allow her free rein and to spend as much money as she needed to make these party films. She made two very important documentary films based on party rallies. The first one was 1933. The film was called Victory of Faith. And the second one is the more famous one, Triumph of the Will. First one convinced them that they had been right. When I teach Leni Riefenstahl's films, one has the difficult task of both making them understand the extent to which she was genuinely a genius at what she was doing and that she developed new innovations, but at the same time that she was responsible for creating more than any other filmmaker, and I would say even his own personal photographer, responsible for making his image the image that it became, and which then allowed Hitler, obviously, to develop certain kinds of powers and control that he would never have been able to do without reaching this kind of iconic status. And so, in terms of her denials about what she knew and didn't know or whatever, she herself focuses completely on the fact that she is an artist and she believes in the beautiful. She has said many times that if she were in the Soviet Union, she would have made a beautiful film celebrating the Communist Party. Or if she were asked to make a film about vegetables, she would make a beautiful film about vegetables, that it doesn't make any difference what the object is. It's very clear that she was an opportunist and saw that she would be able to do what she wanted to do and chose either not to see or to see and not want to know the extent to what was going on in the Third Reich. I happen to believe that she knew a lot more than she ever said. And I teach my students that, but what I think is important is to emphasize the impact of what she did, which was to that extent horrible, because by building that image, then there was an enabling of Hitler to move into the program. You can't call her a Holocaust denier, because she's never said the Holocaust didn't happen. You can call her someone who has contributed enormously to what eventually developed in the policies of the Third Reich.
Leni Riefenstahl died yesterday at 101. David Bathrick is professor and chair of theater, film, and dance and former chair of German studies at Cornell University. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.